In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
This is a CBC podcast.
There was this moment in my conversation with Susan Musgrave, the poet, where she just finished telling me a little bit about the deaths of her daughter and her husband, and she sort of casually says, "I haven't been able to write." Susan is here to talk about her life, her brilliant new poetry collection, which she wrote as a way to process her grief. But she'll talk about what it feels like when you're not ready to write again. Susan Musgrave coming up. Plus, Vivek Shraya is here to talk about an interesting dynamic, how she as a woman of color is in a relationship with a white man and he gets kudos and she gets criticized. That's the topic of her new song, Colonizer. She'll be here to talk a little bit about why she wanted it to be a duet. That's coming up. I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. Here's what you need to know about the poet Susan Musgrave. She has been through a lot. She's been publishing poetry for over 50 years. She was in a psychiatric facility when she was 14 years old. A poet visited her and told her that she was a poet. And since then, she's gone on to become one of this country's most important poets. She's also been married to two different convicted criminals, including a bank robber. And if you've never read a Susan Musgrave poem before, all of these lives that she's lived, they're there in her poetry, including, and we do talk about this, the death of her daughter, Sophie. Susan's latest poetry collection is called Exculpatory Lilies. It's her 19th book of poetry. It's made the shortlist for the Griffin Poetry Prize, which is this country's richest poetry prize. Susan Musgrave joined me from her home on Haida Gwaii. And before we started the interview, I read her this quote from the Vancouver Sun. "Reading Musgrave is like downing a cold beer while being tattooed on a hot day." Here's our conversation. How are you?
I'm great. I didn't know about the cold tattoo on a hot day, or was it the hot tattoo on a cold day?
I tell you, a cold tattoo doesn't sound, or a hot tattoo doesn't sound too good to me.
No.
It was having a cold beer while getting a tattoo on a hot day.
Right. You can see where, okay. Well, I hadn't read that before. That's sort of interesting. Wow. I haven't got any tattoos either, so can't really, or I don't drink beer. So, but anyway, maybe my poetry is like that, but not me.
You don't have to do it because your poetry does it for you. Congratulations on the Griffin. That's a great news. How are you feeling about it?
Well, I was really down. All my life, I've been very down on prizes until I got shortlisted. And now I think they're amazing. Of course, you know, it puts a lot of, almost on one book, whereas, of course, in the country we have, I don't know how many books of poetry published in a year. I've been on juries where I've read 150, 200, lots of poetry. So, and I understand wanting it to be one prize. That makes sense because the Impact, the Booker, all those prizes, big prizes are international. So why not? But I feel kind of embarrassed, I suppose. It's hard to be public. I've been much more private in my life in the last 20 years. And so, but it's brought me out of a very bad time in my life. My daughter died in 2021 of an overdose of fentanyl and benzos. And I just shut down for a year and a half. So this has really awakened me. It reminded me of what I'm supposed to do, which is write, not sit around grieving. Grieving takes a lot of energy. So many people are grieving about so many, you know, deaths, that there's a link. I have a real connection to people, especially mothers of children who've died in this particular, whatever it is, not a pandemic, but it's a crisis, I guess, these opioids. So it's been very helpful for me emotionally to be shortlisted, put it that way. But it's also nerve-wracking because I feel like I'm in grade 5 again. And am I going to win the medal for coming first? And that was the hugest thing in my life. I've even lost my little medals. I had all these little bronze medals. And Denise Mooney, my rival, who actually ran off with a bank robber, that's very odd because that was my life too, she won in grade 5 because the principal said if I won two or three years in a row, I'd think I'd have to keep that up. And I was so disillusioned. I remember thinking, well, I'm just not going to try anymore. And then my marks went down to C's and normal marks, and I didn't come first anymore. So I hope, so it's reminding me of those, of the nervousness of will I come first? But
you're still getting in competition for the medal, you know?
Absolutely true. Getting this far is extraordinary. And as I say, there are so many other books that I see as being just as worthy. That's the thing about competitions. It's all to do with jurors, and having been on lots, I know not to take it personally. It's just the way it falls.
What was the Canadian literature scene like when you first started writing?
Oh, Al Purdy edited an anthology of 50 Canadian poets, and I think there were two women in it. One was P.K. Page and one was Dorothy Livesey. And one of the first reviews from Songs of the Sea, which came out when I was 19, was that I wrote circles around all of the women poets in the country and most of the men. So it was a different time. It was, I think there just weren't a lot of women writing. So I got stuck with this West Coast sea witch label of being the crazy West Coast young woman. That was my label for many years. And it took a lot to overcome that, to grow out of that image. Because once you get stuck with something when you're young, I think it stays. And that one did. Very different. No inclusivity. I don't think there was just such a different world now. It's gone, turned right around.
Was there a community? Was there a Canadian literature community?
There was. Yeah, there was. But, I look back at anthologies that McClellan Stewart published in the 20s and 30s. I don't recognize a single name. That always puts things in perspective. You think, okay, in 100 years, will anybody recognize anybody's name? Or I grew up with a father who read the classics or the romantics, Keats and Shelley, and would always ask me, will your work last? Well, I didn't know if I would last, because I grew up, in the time of the atom bomb and ducking and covering at school. And it wasn't really, I never thought about whether my poetry would last. I still don't. It's a miracle to me that who knows why anything lasts, but if you just do what you have to do. I mean, I just write because that's how I've kept marginally sane over the years, it's helped me get through most things, and it's why grief has been the first thing that has really stopped me from writing. Nothing else ever did. So it's been a strange year.
I want to talk a little bit more about that, because I mean that really does shine through the collection you mentioned. But I kind of want to know more about what you said about your dad there, that he was sort of into the classics. Like Keats and Shelley, what kind of poetry were you writing when you first started? More like that?
Or? Oh, yeah. I read Tennyson's collected work, and then I listened to Bob Dylan. So my early poems were a cross between Tennyson and Bob Dylan, if you can imagine. My grandfather's comment when reading my first book was, even Shakespeare had to write a lot of rubbish to begin with. I always thought it was lovely. That was a backhanded compliment, but still a compliment.
What was it? Do you remember your first one?
My first poem?
Yeah.
Oh, well, one of my first ones is very short. Life is like a candle. Blow it and it's gone.
That's pretty good.
Oh, but I also found, this is Tennyson here, on the door of Chris Andre's house in the Uplands in Victoria. We all did LSD. I was, I think, 14. And I wrote on the door in pencil, is there in this field of gypsies and the emptiness of their wandering songs, is there a favored child of beauty, bruised and irremediably bereft? That's pretty good for 14. And but there it is. I went to a reunion, and 30, 40 years later, that poem is still printed on the door. Oh, with anonymous underneath it. I didn't sign my name.
Oh, it says anonymous?
I think it does, yeah. I've always wanted to be, I mean, that's the greatest thing, the greatest thing you can reach, right? Anonymous. It's just, who doesn't want to be that?
Yeah. What was the reaction you talked to me about your grandfather and all that, but how was your friends and your family and all that stuff when you started wanting to write poetry?
Oh, I just wrote it. I grew up in a house where you weren't supposed to talk back, have opinions, don't contradict. And my father would say, that's enough, that's the end of it. And I'd think, well, no, it's not. So I'd go up into my room and put on something with a heavy bass that irritated my parents downstairs, and usually Rolling Stones, and then Dylan, and then I'd write poetry. And nobody could really silence me when it came to poetry. I just wrote what I wanted, all that teenage angst. And that's the one place, it was just the place I could go to. And so I did that for years. And when I was in my parents had me committed, I think when I was about 16, to a psychiatric ward. And Robin Skelton, the poet, came to visit me there. He'd met my psychiatrist at a drinks party. And the psychiatrist said that there was a girl in room zero, which Kafka would have loved, writing poetry. So Robin came to visit me and he said this famous line, "You're not mad, you're a poet." Well, I didn't think I was mad. I thought my parents were, of course. It's still 30 years later, I read that line. I thought that was a lovely thing to tell me. You know, it was really, that was a lovely thing to have said to me. This young girl, I was, you know, 16 and didn't know anything about. He also brought me Ariel by Sylvia Plath and Allen Ginsberg's Howl. So my poems, instead of being about, you know, Tennyson and Dylan as my influences, Sylvia Plath and Allen Ginsberg crept into my early poetry.
I mean, that'll shift you into the dark clouds a little bit.
Right. Yeah, I was called a chance daughter of Ginsberg and Sylvia Plath, which I thought was interesting.
let me reintroduce you here. Susan Musgrave is my guest. We're talking about her Griffin Poetry Prize shortlisted book, Exculpatory Lilies. I find that very funny, Exculpatory Lilies.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you do. Many people can't pronounce it, so I say it's lilies, lilies.
I like it. It's the flowers you get when you do something wrong, I suppose.
Right. Yeah. Exonerated from guilt. Well, the title poem is that my husband, when the last time he was addicted to heroin. I mean, I tried to be kind. It's just, I didn't know anything about addiction. I didn't grow up with addiction. Most people choose partners. If you end up with an addict, you've had that experience in your childhood. A lot of the time, because it's something you're familiar with. So I just thought you flushed things down the toilet. You flushed the heroin, you flushed the needle. Well, I soon learned that's not what to do. And anger doesn't work. I mean, all I could do was be kind. But he would, when he'd bring me flowers like that, I'd think, I don't want flowers. I want you. No, I want my husband. And the title comes from a cartoon that was in The New Yorker by Michael Crawford, and the woman unwrapping a bouquet, and she says, it's been weeks since you brought me exculpatory lilies. I just liked it. I've had it for years in my mind as a title, and then it seemed to, I think that title poem was one of the last I wrote in this collection, and it seemed to fit.
Your husband, who you're referring to there, for people who don't know, I mean, was Stephen Reed, the author who died in 2018, author, bank robber, part of the notorious Stopwatch gang of bank robbers, was serving time when you met. I didn't know that story before. I mean, I knew your work. I didn't know about him and the bank robberies before I started doing research for this.
Well, he's way more famous than I am. I mean, I'll be a footnote in history to this little married to. I'm already in Montreal's Irish Mafia because of his partner, Patty Mitchell, who is Irish. So I figured I'd made it socially when I got into Montreal's Irish Mafia. So I can bring this up anytime somebody's annoying me on, you know, in my daily life. You know, you better be careful with me because I'm in Montreal's Irish Mafia. Yeah, Stephen was, Bob McEwen on Fifth Estate did quite a number of shows with him. We did one, CBC, The Poet and the Bandit, was a Life and Times documentary. And then Bob did one, My Friend the Bank Robber, because they were old friends from years ago. And it was the sweetest show. It was the last one he did, I think.
Hello, I'm Bob McEwen. Welcome to the Fifth Estate. I was at the Ottawa airport, my flight delayed by the Challenger disaster, when I picked up a copy of the Ottawa Citizen. In it was a story about my long-lost pal, Stephen Reed. It turned out he was in prison in British Columbia and that he'd written a novel about, what else, bank robbery.
So, yeah, Stephen was just a lovely... He got a half a page in the New York Times when he died, which I thought was amazing because he would have loved that, right next to a picture of Obama. I thought, wow, there he is. Too late, maybe he can't see it. He was a lovely man, a gentleman, a gentleman bank robber. He wanted to rob banks wearing a great, like one of those long coats. Jesse James, he wanted to do a daylight bank robbery on horseback. He was kind of old school. I said, well, it's not going to really work going up to the coast capital in Masset on your horse. They're going to know who you are, Stephen, even with a stocking over your face.
Could you read A Spirit in Human Form?
Yeah, it's a poem about Stephen. The book is really a poem. It's Stephen and Sophie's book, and Sophie was his daughter, and I'm glad he died before she did, because it would have absolutely killed him. And I think they're together as much as I know what goes on after life. So I'm hoping they are. Anyway, here's the poem. It's called A Spirit in Human Form. Even while you still lived, it seemed you breathed something headier than air. Part gangster, you swore no one would show up at your funeral for fear of being made. Part family man, you were good at what you did as long as you stayed clean. Drugs don't care who they kill. The lasting mark you left on our lives was a blood stain, albeit heart-shaped because that was your way, but still a stain. Grief's a whirlpool of possibilities, all of them calling for change.
The lasting mark you left on our lives was a blood stain, albeit heart-shaped because that was your way. You have an ability in these poems to hold a lot of conflicting ideas at the same time, Susan, that you can love someone and that they can still hurt you, you know, mm-hmm. that you can be good and you can be bad.
Right. Well, people will say you married, you know, a criminal. I said, no, I married a man. I actually met Stephen because I read his novel, Jackrabbit Parole, that the criminologist had given me the manuscript. Stephen was at Millhaven in near Kingston. And so I read the book, and it was a 90-page novella, and sent it to McClellan Stewart, who offered him a contract on the basis of this. So it's this character I fell in love with, and I thought, I bet he's like this character. And sure enough, he was. If it hadn't been for drugs, he could have been a really good criminal and a really good parent, or both.
Does writing help you process those sort of dualities?
I think so. I mean, dualities aren't they everywhere? And that's what's maybe interesting in a person. As long as marriage contains a mystery, it works. And Stephen was always a mystery because I never knew what he was going to do next. That's pretty common with addicts. You don't know. You just don't know. So you're always on tenterhooks. So many people arrived when he was arrested in 99. I just had a freezer full of things I labeled grief soup, because everybody brings soup when there's some sort of calamity. I had a lot of soup, and people I'd never known or met. And he'd done something. He'd stopped. Their car was broken down the side of the road, and he drove them. You know, all these little things that you do in a community that makes you human and makes you lovable. I'm known as the bank robber's wife. So I have to, when I explain where my house is, I go into elaborate explanations of I live across this bridge and blah, blah, blah. A goose on the roof, Canada goose, decoy. And then I say, oh, it's the bank robber's house. And they go, oh, the BC Hydro. Oh, yes. Now we know the one we thought. So a shortcut to having to make a long explanation.
But it is an unconventional life. And I wouldn't dare talk about your personal life more than you want to. But my God, I mean, like, I think Stephen was the second convicted felon you married, right?
Yeah, the last thing I was looking for was somebody in prison, because my first husband was a criminal lawyer. And my second was, I met him when he was in prison. He'd smuggled, I think 30 tons of pot. This is before BC Bud. So it was, you know, it wasn't like bringing coals to Newcastle. It was bringing a huge freighter full of pot from Colombia. So I then went off with Paul, and we got married. And then he went back to prison and became a born again Christian. And it was very hard for me to communicate with him, because he had a personal relationship with Jesus and I didn't.
Yeah.
So unfortunately,
it's like having a third person in the relationship in that way, right? You know,
and especially when it's Jesus, it's pretty hard to, you know, pretty hard it's a pretty hard rival. Well, we're all many things. We all contain multitudes, right? And that's, I think everyone does. So
do you want to talk about Sophie?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
You mentioned earlier, and I'll catch people up so that you don't have to here. 3 years after you lost Stephen, you lost your daughter Sophie to an accidental drug overdose. Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, she struggled with addiction for years. I was mm-hmm. trying to figure out what I wanted you to read. I thought maybe The Goodness of the World.
Mm-hmm. That's a whole long series I wrote, really to keep myself sane, because I think it was 2014. She was on the street in Vancouver and Kelowna, and she'd lose her ID was always being stolen. And I thought, you know, how will they identify your body? That was the line I'd go to bed with every night. And so I'd get her a new ID. And the year before she died, I was with her in Calgary. We went to Banff, and she was using fentanyl then. And I remember saying, Sophie, I can't save you. I tried to save your dad. I can't save anybody. And whenever she texted me, it was, Mom, I'm alive. And we were very, very close. So this poem is, it's a long section, but this was number 5 in a section called Personal Effects, prefaced with a quote from Nietzsche, "You must have chaos within you to give birth to a dancing star." We used to joke, you like to sniff the glue that held our family together, but this much is true. Everything in our house had been broken and mended over and over again. I felt at home in all the broken places, as if I could only find beauty in hurt things. The antique floor lamps with irreplaceable parts missing and stands full of wrecked umbrellas nestled together like crippled bats. I couldn't throw anything out because it was chipped or cracked, or even when it fell to pieces in my hands. My fault was in trying to fix you, who taught me all life on earth is the dust of ruined stars. Words for your headstone carved by a hard-bitten wind when the dust settles were left with dust. She was a very wise person. I mean, the problem with somebody, a child dying of an overdose, it's not really a problem, but when I read the biographies, parents all say the same thing. She was witty. She loved animals. She would have given away her last dime to somebody on the street. And I'm thinking, geez, maybe it's best to bring kids up not to love animals, not to be funny, not to be gracious and give things away.
Yeah.
Maybe those are the survivors in this life. But they often say those things, and I don't think they've read them. It doesn't sound like they've read them elsewhere. It sounds like those were really, that's what those people were. They were really lovely human beings who were addicts. So I guess writing about Sophie, I wanted people to know that she was more than what just her fate was.
More of my conversation with the poet Susan Musgrave right after this.
Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
I think there isn't the stigma now about alcohol, but there still is sort of about drugs, as if you brought it on yourself.
I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. Let me give you some background on what you just heard. So you're in the middle of my conversation with the poet and author Susan Musgrave. Her 19th book of poetry is called Exculpatory Lilies, and it's on the shortlist for the Griffin Poetry Prize. The winner is announced tomorrow night on June 7th. So in the first part of our conversation, we were talking about how this whole collection is Susan's way of expressing her grief over the loss of her husband, Stephen Reed, and then their daughter, Sophie, just 3 years later. So in this part of our conversation, she tells me after a lifetime of processing her own life experience through her work, lately she just hasn't been able to write. Here's more of my conversation with Susan Musgrave. You said you stopped for a while writing mm-hmm. after Sophie died.
Mm-hmm.
And you've been writing your entire life,
mm-hmm.
Always about everything.
Yep. Since I was in grade four.
How, what happened that you started? And did it help?
I haven't.
Really?
No, I haven't written a poem. But in the last month, titles and lines have been coming into my head. I don't force things. I don't sit down and say, Susan, you have to write a poem today. Get over this. In a way, I think I was just, I'm very obstinate, that Irish thing in me, that Anglo-Irish thing of just being so stubborn that, you know, I've met First Nations women who strip their arms of their bracelets, gold and silver bracelets that are carved when their children die. And some people cut their hair. And I thought, what can I give her? That's the greatest gift, be not writing another word. It was like, I'm saying, see what you've done? I love you this much that I'm never going to write. And that's kind of what was going on in the back of my mind, in my subconscious. And I think I convinced myself that I was not writing for Sophie. And that was, I think really she wouldn't like that. She'd go, Mama, what are you doing? This is, you can't do that. I can do whatever I want, Sophie. Those are the conversations. You left me. You went away. So I'm trying to get over that because I know how stubborn I am. I can convince myself that if I write something, I'm somehow betraying her memory. And that absolutely is not true, my conscious mind is saying. But so it's a, I have to get over this peculiar thing. Maybe years of, next 20 years of therapy, maybe. And I think that's called grieving. And we all grieve so differently. And also sometimes the same. I've been reading a wonderful book called The Grieving Brain. And it's just, it's really helped me because I knew there had to be some neuroscience that was explaining why after a year and a half or two, which is fairly short time, but that I was still feeling this way. And apparently our brains are not equipped to deal with this kind of loss, even though we've had maybe other losses. The brain still cannot understand how a person can be here and then not be here. So then I can say, aha, it's my brain. It's not understanding. It's not me.
Yeah.
Coming downstairs and finding your dining room table's been stolen in the night, you go, well, I didn't hear anybody move it. Like, where's it gone? And for the next month, you walk around the space where it was because you haven't learned that it's not there. And that really helped me because images help. I think, okay, that's the dining room table. Sophie's more than that, but she more than a piece of furniture. But like, where? I drive around town saying, Sophie, where are you? Where are you? So then I read this book. I thought, oh, that's really helpful. It's not that I'm crazy. It's that my brain is just trying to make sense of something that is no longer in this dimension.
Right, right. Susan, I'm grateful to you for talking to me about that.
Well, thank you. It's actually great to talk to you too, Tom. I don't mind talking about it. I mean, because I know I'm just not alone. There's so many.
That's what stuck out to me when you were saying, you know, I've met so many people on Haida Gwaii or so many people in BC, like who have lost children to the overdose crisis in this country right now. What went through my mind is you're on the CBC right now, and I can't think of somebody in this country listening to this who's not affected by it in some way or another. You know,
right? I would agree. I get so many emails anytime I'm on the radio with just with people telling me their story. And I had a woman who came to stay at my guest house. Her son died of an overdose on Christmas Eve. She was Haida, waiting for the body to be shipped home. She phoned. I just started crying. I said, I can't charge you. Just come bring your whole family, stay. And then Jessica, who's now running across the province or walking across the BC to raise awareness somehow to safe supply. Her son died last August. She came and stayed with me for a week. So I have this kind of house of bereavement in Massett, but a lot of joy there too. And it's just so, there's so many people everywhere. And I wish it would stop. It doesn't seem to be slowing down at all. And there's a stigma. I think it needs to, we don't have the same stigma anymore about alcohol. We've sort of got over that. When I was growing up, people whispered, or your aunt is a bit odd, they'd say, but they never said she's an alcoholic, which would have made me understand her behavior better. Yeah. She had a funny voice. But I think there isn't the stigma now about alcohol, but there still is sort of about drugs, as if you brought it on yourself.
Yeah, as if there's a character flaw, there's something wrong with you.
You brought it on yourself.
Would you have it in you to read a poem before we go?
Yes.
I thought you might read Not Enough.
Right. this comes from my sense of, and I think many writers have it, and many people have a deep sense of unworthiness. And I imagine that comes from childhood, but never being enough. From the generation, if you got 98% on an exam, or it was, where's the other 2%?
Yeah.
A lot of us. And what that does is instill in you the sense of, I can't ever be enough.
Yeah, I know.
So the poem is called Not Enough. The smooth stone does not say to the jagged ocean, you are not enough. The kingfisher to the shining, twisting fish in his beak, you are not enough. The knife does not say to the cutting board, you are not enough. Where does this message come from? The one the mind says to the rest of the body, daily, as we struggle to live on this earth, you are never enough.
Where does this message come from? The one that the mind says to the rest of the body daily, as we struggle to live on this earth, you are never enough. It's a hard lesson that you are enough.
I know. And to accept that. I mean, why don't I accept I am enough? I had a Buddhist teacher who once said, you're not more than or not less than, you are equal to. And I thought, yes, that's true. I am. I'm equal to.
Yeah. I had a teacher one time who taught me, when I was meditating, to say in my mind, this is enough. This is enough. This doesn't have to be more than this. This doesn't have to be less than this. Even just this is enough.
Yes, I know. It is true. Do I believe that? No, but I have a cheat sheet that I can read if I want to remember these things and say, oh, yes, I am equal to.
Thank you so much for talking to me today and telling me your story and just talking to me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's been fun. I don't do fun, so it's been fun. It's lovely. Thank you so much.
I don't do fun is the new tagline for the show, by the way. Susan Musgrave has published over 30 books of poetry, fiction, nonfiction, culinary writing, and children's literature. Her 19th collection of poetry, Exculpatory Lilies, pronounced Lilies, is on the shortlist for the 2023 Griffin Poetry Prize. The winner will be announced tomorrow on June 7th.
Hello, I'm Irina Abramovic. I'm listening to The Cue with Tom Power.
Vivek Shreya has to be one of the busiest artists in Canada right now. She's a published author, lecturing professor, playwright, Canadian Screen Award-winning composer, sometimes commotion panelist, past and future Cue guest host, but above all, a pop star. And what I mean by that is Vivek's done really interesting exploration into her desire to be a pop star. She's done that through her theater piece, How to Become a Pop Star. Her TV show based on that of the same name is coming out from CBC soon. And today she's here with her own pop music. She just released her album, Baby, You're Projecting. And she joined me to set up a song from it. Here's Vivek Shreya. Hi, how are you?
Hi, Tom. How's it going?
It's good. It's very, very interesting to talk to you because I think the last time we talked on air, you hadn't started guest hosting yet, but now
it's true.
Now you've been guest hosting a little bit, sitting in for Elamina and Commotion. You sat in for me, I think maybe end of last year, and right? End of last year?
Was that
last summer?
Yeah.
Well, the reaction to whenever we have you in is so positive, and people love hearing you, so we're happy to have you. And I'm happy to talk a little bit about your music, but before I do that, I know I texted you about this when it happened, but you won your first Canadian Screen Award for your work on the show Sort Of. How did that feel?
It was wild. It's wild, wild, wild. Like, I'm not saying this to be self-deprecating, but I really don't think of myself as a winner. And that's largely because, like, I haven't, like, won, like, a major prize or anything like that. And also, as an artist, it's weird being marginalized. I feel like my work gets categorized as, like, activism, not art. And so any sort of, like, award or recognition I've had has been around activism, even though that's not how I recognize myself or how I see myself. And so to be, like, to win for music, like, of all things, it was just quite shocking to me. To the point that even when I went home with the statue, I was like, are we sure? Like, I kept waiting for someone to, like, knock on the door and be like, excuse me, madam. That wasn't yours to take. We all knew. We just didn't want to tell you. We were like, we're going to give for this moment.
You were worried you got La La Landed.
Exactly.
Well, no, I mean, it was a big deal that you won that. It was a big deal that Sort Of
totally
won that. You know, that was a big deal.
it was really nice. Honestly, like, just, I mean, being part of the sort of family, if I can say that, like, just watching, you know, Bilal and Fab have the success around that show, just really, really tremendous. Like, I think it's such a special show. And I personally have always, always, like, I think being a 90s kid, like, there's such a connection between music and visual. Like, I think, like, I love the art of the soundtrack. Like, I love when music is integrated into TV and film. And I've always wanted to make, like, music for a TV show or movie. Like, I don't know if you remember Magnolia, where Amy Mann did, like, the soundtrack, like, songs throughout. And I was like, that's the goal, that's the dream. So anyways, it was just really, really nice to make music for a TV show and have that recognized.
Well, we were so proud of you here. And I got to tell you, for someone who wrote a show called How to Fail as a Pop Star, you wrote a pretty good pop record here.
Thank you so much. Yeah, thank you. I knew this was coming.
what was going through your mind as you made this record?
I mean, I think How to Fail as a Pop Star in a lot of ways really allowed me to publicly mourn something that I really, really was very attached to in my, like, teenage years, in my 20s and my 30s, even.
Fame.
You know,
wanting fame.
You know, I really struggle with the word fame, because sometimes I feel like fame is like being famous for the sake of being famous, or mm-hmm. being known for the sake of being known. But for me, it's more about, like, wanting to make a connection through my art,
right,
in a massive way. And I didn't get to have that. And I think doing the play over and over again publicly really allowed me to mourn that. And so working on the record, I felt really free. And there's something really exciting on the other side of 40 and failure, in that now I get to write music for myself. And it was really exciting, you know, thinking about, like, what does music look like now, and what do I want to say, and what haven't I said before, and what does it mean to make music when it's not under pressure of, like, trying to appease a label or, you know, a chart or an audience. Like, it really felt like, in some ways, like a gift to myself.
The song we're going to play today is Colonizer. That's a song on your record, but we're going to actually hear the bonus version that is a duet with another good friend of Q, our good friend Donovan Woods. Donovan Woods, for people who don't know, out of Sarnia, Ontario. I mean, not just a tremendous songwriter for himself, but also a great songwriter for a lot of great country artists in Canada and the United States. How did you two connect for this record?
Well, we both work a lot with James Bunton, who is a producer in Toronto. And so, like, I've heard of Donovan, you know, for years and years and years. Also, like, a really big fan of his work. And I wrote Colonizer originally as a duet for my partner, believe it or not, who's a very shy, introverted person. And I was like, come on, let's do it. And he was like, no chance in hell. And so then I actually thought of Donovan. I was like, this might be a really great way to, like, make a connection. And one of the things I love about collabs is it feels like a way to build a relationship and, you know, hopefully start, like, yeah, a kind of, like, friendship, if you will. And so I reached out to Donovan, and he was so generous. And I mean, the first thing he said is, like, you know, if I do this, I'm going to sound like a really stupid white person, aren't I? Because of that, like, I mean, you can hear the lyrics or whatever, but he still did it, which is a credit to him. And I think he totally nailed it and brought that Donovan energy to it. So I'm stoked about it.
What is tell us a little bit about what the song's about before we hear it.
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, again, I think for me, when I think about what I can contribute to pop music, it's specificity in my 40s. And one of the things I don't hear a lot of in pop music is the nature of being in an interracial relationship. And, you know, I've been with a white man for years. And I think that for me, it's challenging because I think people know me as someone who speaks out about racism. And so there's, like, almost this weird feeling of, like, betrayal or shame or judgment that I feel in my communities. Whereas meanwhile, as a white person dating a brown person, I find that he gets lauded. Like, people look at him and are like, good for you. Like, way to woke it up, you know? And so it's this weird, it is this weird tension between us where I feel like he gets celebrated and I get judged and sort of, like, quietly condemned. And so I, you know, really wanted to write a song that, you know, talked about that tension. But at the heart of it, it's really a love song, right? Because I think in any relationship, people project, if you will, and the only people who know what's going on is the people inside. And so, you know, the lyric is like, I don't need a, you know, savior, healer, colonizer, just be my lover, you know? And I think that's the core of it.
You're going to be guest hosting Q in June. So I thought what we could do is give a little sample of that right now. Would you mind saying who you are and introducing the song?
Hi, I'm Vivek Shreya, and you're listening to Colonizer with Donovan Woods.
You're a white man, and I'm a brown girl. You have my hand, but you don't know my world. I will never know how much your love is just the validation. And there will never be a clear answer for this question. So I don't need a healer, savior, colonizer. Just be my lover. Savior, colonizer. Just be my lover. Just be my lover. You're a brown girl, and I'm a white man. And I love you, girl, but I can't comprehend how I will always look that much better. Loving someone of color, why you will always look a little like you betrayed your culture. So I won't be a healer, savior, colonizer. I'll be your lover. I won't be a healer.
From a brand new album, Baby, You're Projecting, Vivek Shreya and Donovan Woods, my old buddy, with the song Colonizer on Q. All right, that's it for the show today. If you're not already subscribed to this podcast, if you're listening casually, if you're pressing per episode and you're not subscribed to the podcast, feel free. I would love for you to do so, to subscribe to our podcast, Q with Tom Power, wherever you got this one. If you want to get in touch with me, the best way to do that is probably email q@cbc.ca, and I check my Instagram DMs way too often. I'm at Tom Joe Power. All right, see you soon. Later on.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.